Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras, the number one podcast for bow hunting product information and hunting stories from across the nation. And now, here's your nine-fingered host, Dan Johnson.
It's halfway through the week. The week is almost over, and Friday is getting closer and closer and closer, which means Saturday is getting closer and closer and closer. And I don't know about you guys, but as much time as I spend in front of a computer, whether it is doing my real job or, you know, behind the computer and the microphone doing this podcast, it's always nice to get away from everything and get out and just decompress and disconnect for a little bit. And that's what I'm going to be doing this upcoming weekend. Kind of a real funny story. My dad works with a guy who raises fainting goats. So if you smack your hands or yell real loud, they'll stiffen up and fall over. You can go to YouTube and check it out. It's hilarious. But we're going to be taking my son and my daughter to this farm, and I cannot wait to see, what happens with these fainting goats. So it could get really interesting this weekend. If I remember, I'll be sure to post some videos on the Facebook page. But today we have kind of a first for this podcast. We're going to be talking with a guy named Nick, and Nick is going to talk to us today about quality deer management and QDMA, and how he got involved, how he brought some of those principles into his property, how he has seen direct results from those principles and implementing those principles, not only planting food plots on his property, but also implementing habitat improvements like, you know, some hinge cutting and, you know, making it thick and nasty in there for the deer to have, you know, all the things that deer need: water, food, and cover. And so he's going to go into detail about a farm that he basically started from scratch on and how he has seen the results over the past years. And he kind of just basically shares the story of what he's done and how he's done it. And that's something we don't really talk a lot about on this podcast, but it's part, a lot of people do it. So I felt, hey, why not get a regular Joe on who has done it and has seen success from it. And hopefully you guys like it. Now, before we get into today's podcast, let's hear what the owner of Ripcord Arrowrest, Keith Dvorsnak, has to say about their lifetime warranty.
Here at Ripcord, we have a lifetime warranty on your rest. So you purchase that rest, I don't care if your dog got in there and ate it, we're going to cover it. You run it over with a four-wheeler, we're going to cover it. You get bucked off a horse in the backcountry, something happens, bends, you know, we understand. We're all bow hunters here, too. Things happen. We stand behind our product 110%. We know that it'll work, and it works great. Something happens to it, though, we're going to stand behind it.
And there you go. If you guys want to find out more information about Ripcord Arrowrests, be sure to visit ripcordarrowrest.com or visit your local bow shop or dealer or box store. I think they're just about everywhere. Check them out. And if you have any questions, go to the website, read up on the products and what they can all offer. And I'm sure you guys will be impressed. Now, let's get into today's BS Session podcast with Nick Lundgren. Nick Lundgren, how are we doing?
Good, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing pretty good. So today we are, wait a second, before I even get into any of that, you're from New York, right?
Correct.
Now, did you get hammered with a lot of snow recently?
Yeah, I'm actually a teacher, so I've had the last 2 days off of school. We had snow days because We've had basically constant snow since Monday night. It just stopped maybe like 20 minutes ago. We probably got about a foot of snow, but which is not crazy for us. You know, we usually get a bunch, but it was bad enough where they decided to cancel school, I guess. So
Now, do you get that lake effect snow, or is it?
Oh yeah,
is this part of that nor'easter that came through?
Well, this I think is a nor'easter because, to be honest, if we got lake effect, this we would have gotten three or four times the amount that we've gotten if it snowed for that long. Like,
gotcha.
We've had 2014, we had 6 feet of snow around my house. Like, it was insane. So it's this is definitely not lake effect, I don't think, this time around.
So shed hunting's on the back burner for at least a little while, right?
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. I'm pretty busy right now anyways with stuff, so I'm kind of happy it'll be pushing it off until I'm ready, which is another week or two. So.
Nice. All right, so you live in southwestern New York. Why don't you tell us where you live and what you do for a living?
Okay, so I live in a suburb of Buffalo, West Seneca, so just south of Buffalo. I grew up in Chautauqua County, New York, which is the southwesternmost county, literally right on the Pennsylvania border. My property is literally right on the border. So that's where I grew up. That's where I hunt. That's where I spend, you know, all my hunting time. But I work and live in right outside of Buffalo right now. And I'm 32 years old, and I am a high school technology teacher. So I teach shop. I teach wood shop right now. That's kind of what I do. There's a wide scope of things that we could teach, but basically right now I'm just teaching wood shop.
Gotcha. Now, I'm just going to speak from what I know about high school. In high school, I was an asshole, and I probably was not very respectful to my teachers. Is high school these days, I just feel that high school kids these days are even more assholes, bigger assholes than what I used to be. Is that something that you can comment on?
Most days I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
Kind of like not really happy with, you know, the attitude and stuff. But the thing that I kind of say about being a teacher is, like, you know, for like every, you know, I don't know, unfortunately, I'm probably going to get lambasted for this, but I would say, unfortunately, like 50, 60% of the kids can be assholes. They probably all won't end up end up that way, but at least they act like that when they're teenagers, which you and I probably were the same. So but the rest of them, you know, make up for it. So, you know, if I have one really good encounter with a good kid every day, that's, you know, that makes it worth it.
Gotcha.
I have had, you know, a lot of good stuff, but it's, they definitely, can be a pain in the ass for sure. So
I'll tell
and
you.
And then try to teach them how to use a, you know, miter saw and table saw along with that.
Okay. I got to tell a shop class, story real quick.
All right.
And I'm gonna lead up to this shop class story with a kind of a side story. Where have you ever noticed that in certain rooms, in certain buildings, if you open one door, the pressure in the room kind of shifts, and like another door will rattle or click or something like that. All right, so now you kind of get the gist of it here. But when I was in middle school, all the girls were in our shop class, all the girls were supposed to wear like ponytails. Well, we were making some kind of shelf or something, whatever eighth graders do. And it was hot. So the shop teacher opened up the window the door to the outside to, cool it off or get some air circulating through. Well, the girl that I was working with out of my group of three, her hair kind of blew in the wind and got caught in a bandsaw that was running, and it pulled her head down like someone like just pushed her head into the metal part of it, and it ripped her hair out. It didn't like pull her hair into the saw, but it ripped her hair out, and she's okay, but I can sit back and laugh at that now. So I'm sure
that's the kind of stuff I like have nightmares about.
Yeah, right. So I look back on it and I could see like Will Ferrell doing some kind of skit in one of his movies about it.
Yeah, I agree. I am lucky with so far. I've been teaching for 7 years. I haven't had any kids get seriously injured. I'm the only one that's gotten seriously injured. This year I had a piece of wood kick back on the table saw and took a chunk of my finger off, but
I know what that's all about.
Not too bad. Yeah. I'm like 9 7/8 fingers. Nine. But.
That'd be a long URL for a podcast. 9 7/8 Fingers Chronicles podcast.
Yeah.
All right. So today we're going to talk about you, your hunting, and then a little bit about QDMA and you starting with another guy, starting a QDMA branch. Now, I have a lot of questions in regards to this, but leading up to this, before you started this branch, before you started practicing quality deer management in your area, talk to us a little bit about what hunting was like, whether we want to talk about numbers, we want to talk about, buck to doe ratio, herd health, or, you know, why a lot of people do what they do, big bucks. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Okay. So I'll just give you like a quick overview of how I got into it and then like, you know, tell you that kind of stuff. So basically I started hunting because my grandfather, he still owns 106 acres in that area I was mentioning before. And he deer hunted. He had a small beef cattle farm and then he hunted deer and he always hunted quite a bit and he loved to hunt, but he only deer hunted with a gun. At that time it was a shotgun. Right. And he kind of got me into it. No one else in my family, my father, no one else in my family hunted. It was never really, but for some reason, you know, I kind of think back to like the Wired to Hunt podcast when you talked to Donnie Vincent about how he says that everybody's kind of wired to hunt and everybody has something deep down that, you know, makes them a hunter. And some people just choose to participate and some people choose not to. Right. And I just feel like it was inevitable that I was going to be a hunter and going to be big into it. You know, my mother always laughs and says like, when I was little, I never knew anything about hunting because I wasn't around it much. And she would always say, whenever she asked me what I wanted to wear, everything was always camouflage. And she's like, I don't even know where you figured that out. So it's just, it's one of those things. But so I started hunting and, you know, the big thing, and I think the way to explain kind of New York State hunting is I remember a guy telling me when I was young, I was probably 12 years old, 13 years old, you know, really kind of getting some interest in hunting. At that time, you couldn't gun hunt until you were 16. But I remember the guy saying to me, well, you only get one shot at a buck a year. And, wow. You know, what did I know any better? I was like, oh, okay. You know, so basically what that kind of encompasses is basically people in New York, you know, back in the day, especially if they saw a buck, they shot it, you know,
like no matter what,
basically, it's funny because my grandfather, he's a really laid back guy, you know, and he got to a point when I remember it, I was a teenager or young, you know, maybe middle school age where he said, I'm not going to shoot every buck I see now. I'm going to shoot a 6-point or bigger, you know? And that was like maybe the first time I ever heard anybody say that they would let a deer go. And he actually got like, you know, ribbed by his buddies because he was telling them that he kind of passed up a couple bucks, you know, a year. Because at that time he was retired. He hunted every single day of the season. And I just remember thinking that. And, you know, I didn't really give a lot of thought to it. But so basically I started hunting myself when I was 16. And at that time, I was lucky there was the deer population in New York was really high. The buck to doe ratio is always kind of out of whack just because so many year and a half old bucks get shot. But there was a ton of deer, ton of does. And like you'd go hunting anytime and you'd see, you know, 25 deer. And so I shot, you know, the first few deer I shot, there was some does and a small buck within my first two seasons probably. And I started hunting with my friends a little bit, and that was where I really got into like the other side of it, which was like doing deer drives and stuff. So I, you know, my grandpa never did a deer drive. We basically, he was a tree stand hunter, and yeah, he didn't really, or ground blind. He had no interest in, you know, pushing deer, but I, you know, I did a few deer drives for like maybe the first 3-4 years of my hunting career. And I just, I kind of realized like towards the end, it's fun. You get to hang out with your buddies and, you know, you see some deer, but we never once, I never saw a big buck, and I don't think we ever killed a buck, period. We killed a few does with the deer drives, and we were always pushing deer, but it just wasn't effective. And I just felt like it wasn't really hunting, you know. And yeah, you know, I'm not saying anything's wrong with deer drives, you know, just personally it's not my thing. Like, you know, whatever, I'm not, you know, I try not to be, tell other people what they should or shouldn't do. It's just, to me, I just didn't care much for it. So I kind of stepped away from that. And I kind of basically said to myself, well, I have a piece of property that I'm, you know, my luck's lucky enough, my grandfather left me and my sister the property, and he's still alive, but he's signed it over to us. And he said, or I said to myself, you know, it's, I have this piece of property and it's decent. Like there's deer there and, you know, it's, there's some fields. It's probably 70% timber and the rest is fields. And, I'm like, I want to try to make this, you know, a good spot to hunt. So I've always kind of had this mindset of things where, you know, I don't want to accept something if it isn't the way I want it to be. So I'm going to try to change it to make it better. And I was lucky with the timing of, you know, my age and everything. When I was getting into hunting is when a lot of this land management stuff really started to come out. And there was a lot of information, you know, available to me for that. And I just started doing as much research as I can. And, you know, to, probably to anybody could say that the first thing I started was a food plot. So basically it was tough to get my grandfather to be on board with that because he did hay and, you know, he was a farmer. So he wanted to use everything, you know, and get something out of it. So, like I planted clover or something in this field one year, I finally convinced him to do it. And then he wouldn't let me mow it until he was ready to bale it up. And
yeah,
I was like, well, I, you know, that's not, you're kind of not getting that. Like, that's not the point. I want to mow it and keep it short so the deer will constantly eat it. So eventually he got out of the haying business and then I kind of had full rein. And I was really lucky because not only did I have this property that I just had full, you know, access to do whatever the heck I wanted, but he was also, you know, comparatively speaking to most 87-year-old men, he's pretty laid back, and he's has, you know, we had all the farming equipment, plows, discs, you know, drags, right, everything, track. We have four tractors. Like, I have everything at my fingertips to kind of make things like that happen. And he, you know, I was definitely like the laughing stock of the town after a while, or the area, because everybody didn't understand what the heck I was doing. Like, why is he up there cutting down trees and leaving them? Or why is he up there, you know, planting, why is he spending all his money on seed and fertilizer and stuff and just leaving it? And, you know, it's kind of hard for people that don't understand it to see why you're doing it. And my grandpa, he was right there with everybody else, but he didn't care that I did it. He was happy. Like, he, yeah, I think he missed working in the fields and stuff. So he was right there with me until he physically couldn't anymore. To, you know, he was like my farmhand. He'd be calling me during the week because I don't live on the farm. So
right,
he'd be calling me during the week saying, what do you need me to do? Do you need me to plow up this field? Or do you need me to do this or do that? So, you know, it started with food plots. And, I didn't really notice a huge difference. You know, I never really saw deer in those fields during the daylight very often until we started planting food plots. Like, it was always, I always hunted in the woods. So after the food plots started, and then eventually went into more things where I had created some cover and things like that, I started to see some huge, huge changes. And really, a big thing that happened to me that was kind of a nice feather in my cap for what I was doing was my grandpa, when he was hunting, I think it was probably 2012 or 2013, he said, I've never seen the deer hunting this good. And he said, I know it's because of everything you've been doing.
Yeah.
And it was funny for me. I mean, he's owned that land since he was 27. So for 60 years, you know, he's owned that land. So 60 years of hunting too. So he's been able to see the best hunting he's ever seen in the last, you know, 10 since I've been kind of changing things. So I take a lot of pride in that.
So when you planted on this piece of property, when you planted that very first food plot, how big was that food plot? And was it like a light switch or was it more of a trickle as far as deer coming to it?
So the very first food plot, it's in what I call now like my main food plot's a 3-acre field.
Okay.
It's all hidden by woods. There's a hedgerow that covers it, so no one can see it from the road. And I would say it was a slow trickle for that one. Two reasons. The first reason is, like I said, my grandpa let it grow. Like through the summer, it grew really high, and then, you know, when we mowed it, I don't know how much came back to the point where the deer were really eating it. But so the first year maybe been kind of a wash. But the other thing is I didn't run a lot of cameras back then. So
Right. It
was maybe hard for me to really determine what was actually happening. But and then thirdly, I had the thing where I was only hunting really in the woods, so I, you know.
Yeah.
There very well could have been deer going there in the daylight, and I may not have ever even known it. So, but it once I kind of transitioned away from that was like a clover mix that I planted, and then once I got out of that, I started doing corn and soybeans, and that was almost like a light switch at that point. So that was maybe like 7 years ago, something like that, 6 years ago.
So now you have this 106 acres, right? And you started off with a 3-acre food plot and then you slowly progressed and started adding multiple food plots. Is that farm now less egg and all kind of a hunting sanctuary now? Or is there still corn and beans that you guys harvest?
No, there's, we don't harvest anything. It's just, it's all totally for hunting. There's one field on there that we leave as hay, because the neighbor and I traded because our property adds up to 106 acres, but there's actually a strip of like 16, 17 acres that splits the two. So it's like a real narrow, maybe 100 yard wide strip. And the neighbor owns that. He never goes on it. He's not a hunter. We've always had access, you know, basically exclusive access to hunt it. But there's a little pasture in there. So basically what I did was I asked him if I could plant a food plot there. And then I would let him hay the field. It's like a 3-acre field.
Gotcha.
So I was asking for like an acre and a half, and he was giving him 3 acres to. Person that bow hunts my 106, you know, if you add in that other, it's like 120 acres or whatever. I'm the only person that bow hunts that. And it's pretty unheard of in our area, that there isn't five or six guys on 100 acres or more.
Gotcha.
So and there's only two people that gun hunt it. One other guy comes and hunts with me for 5 days of the gun season, and that's it. So I wanted them to be on the deer to be, you know, have to bed and feed basically on mine as much as possible. Obviously you're never going to keep them there all the time, but I wanted them there as much as possible because they could easily go, you know, anytime during gun season, if they go across the property line, like they're probably in trouble.
Okay.
So yeah, that's kind of the thing, you know, with this type of a an area where there's, I think it's, I looked at the chart, I want to say it's like 11 to 12 bow hunters per square mile or something like that. Or I don't know if it's bow hunters, but hunters. Like, it's a lot. So it's tough to not have deer survive. So, you know, I think the step one of getting some deer with any kind of age on them is to get them, get your property. Your property needs to have everything that they want. So, and you know, I've had deer that I thought pretty much stayed on mine, and then I've had deer that wandered like crazy. So, you know, right, it's, they got a mind of their own, but you try to do the best you can to give them what they need.
Okay. So specifically, what did you do to your property? Was it hinge cutting? Was it, you know, planting some grasses? Was it, you know, opening up, just removing some of the mature trees so more sunlight hit the ground? What was it specifically that you did?
A little bit of everything, minus the grasses. I haven't gotten into that. I wish I could, but I just don't have the right kind of area to do that. But, okay. I've done probably five or six acres of hinge cutting over the years. And that's helped a lot. It helps to concentrate the deer. And also, one thing I did last year, which was kind of neat, was I did sort of like a travel corridor with hinge cutting. So kind of like almost like a funnel, basically.
Gotcha.
And that, it worked really well. I didn't kill a deer out of it, but I had lots of pictures of all different types of deer walking right down that trail. It was kind of neat to see that. And
nice.
Another thing we did that was huge was, we had a logger come in and he just culled the woods. So he took out everything that was not very good or was shading out a better tree. He took out basically firewood. So it,
right,
we didn't make any money off of it hardly, but it was, you know, the habitat improvement was huge. Probably in, you know, like I said, I've been paying close attention to this for just shy of maybe 10 years. And I want to say that was probably 5-6 years ago.
Okay.
We had that done, and probably that's what the biggest, thing that I've done that has like a really big change. Like when, like a year after that happened, I was just like, wow, this is so much better. Because, and I just noticed deer were living there, staying there on their own. And, you know, a big thing I think in our area is once gun season starts, deer don't move on their own very often in the daylight, because they get pushed so often. So one of the best things for me is to be able to sit through an entire gun season. I think 2013, we had a pretty high deer numbers. I had a lot of does living on my land, and I had, one of the best gun seasons I've ever had, because I literally went out and hunted, and every time I hunted, I saw deer and they were moving on their own. Nobody was pushing them. Nobody was doing deer drives in the neighboring properties. They were on my property bedding, getting up, walking to food or whatever. And it was just so, like, I killed three does, I think, with a rifle that year. That was beside the point, though. It was just, it had nothing to do with me actually killing a deer. It was just the fact that I was watching deer, you know, moving on their own during a time when in the past they would just be shacked up wherever they could hide and, you know, hoping nobody was going to come kick them in the butt, you know?
Right. So at that time, when you did the, you know, the interior timber work and you had the food plots, do you feel that the land improvement, the habitat improvement carried more weight than the planning of the food plots? Or do you think, it was kind of in conjunction with one another that made the property overall better?
I don't know. I think that if you talk to or read from any, you know, good land management person, you know, like examples, like, you know, Jeff Sturgis is someone I would read a lot about. Neil Doherty, I've met Neil a few times. He's fantastic. And they'll all say that, you know, the chainsaw is the best tool that a habitat manager has, you know, has nothing to do with food plots. So,
Right.
I think that's the first thing that comes to my mind is absolutely the timber was the best thing I ever did, you know, hinge cutting and having the timber selectively harvested. But I don't know that for sure if you really dig down, because I've had the food plots first.
Right.
I think they both hold a lot of water, but, you know, like I said, you can have the best food plot ever, and if the closest cover is a mile away, then, you know, they're only going to feed there at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, they're not going to be there in the daylight. So I think that the cover probably was better than the food plots. You know, I think that the food plots are helpful.
That was a visible result, right? That was a visible result. Absolutely. Where you did the work. The next year, you're like, oh my God, it's really paying its dues.
Yeah, and that was the year that my grandfather like made that statement, like, okay, this is the best hunting that I've seen, you know, in 60 years.
And that was 2013, so, you said?
I think that was 2013, if I'm correct. I think that's got to be it.
All right. So, huge thing, you know, a big thing happened. All the work that you did kind of paid off. Did that kind of light a fire under you and was like, okay, now what can I do to do more to my property?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I would say the fire was there too, you know, but I think that, you know, and the other thing too is, you know, I have to give a lot of credit to my one friend. I met this guy in college, and it's funny because we were going to college in the city of Buffalo, and we were both being in orientation, and I'm wearing like a deer hunting hat, and he's wearing maybe a deer hunting t-shirt. And we're like, hey, like, we're the only two people in the orientation. And he's like, hey, you hunt? And I'm like, yeah. So we got to talking, and it turns out that he is actually from the same county that I'm from, and we'd never met. So since then, we've become very good friends, and we kind of helped each other through living in the city through college. And but he has a big, big farm. His father owns like, you know, 600 acres or something, which around here is really big. Right. And big dairy farm. And he was a big hunter, and he had all these great food plots, and he has all this knowledge just from his family because of how good, you know, they're farmers. So they're good at planting everything. And he just has a really good property for deer hunting. And after going hunting with him and on his land and kind of seeing what he did, it really, you know, sparked a huge interest in that for me. And it made me realize, you know, this guy's 20, 25 minutes down the road from my farm, and he's got like a paradise here. So I just want to make mine into that, you know, as best I can. It's a, you know, a fifth of the size, but at least it, you know, I can do the best I can with it. So, and I really feel like I have, you know, and I'm to the point now where I spent a lot of time hunting on other friends' properties and, you know, going around with my buddies. And that was, hunting was a lot about that for me when I was younger, but now it's really just about my own property. And I, like, I love going and spending time with my friends and hunting, but I could care less about shooting a deer on anybody else's property. I just have no interest in it. And I have other places that I can hunt that would maybe be better, you know, than mine, but that's not my goal. My goal is not to kill a deer, you know, or a big deer. My goal is to make my property the best it could be, you know, so that maybe someday I'll get a big deer off of there. You know, like, I would pass up opportunities to go hunt somewhere else to try to learn more about mine to make it better.
Right.
So
now, so you've implemented these changes, you've planted the food plots, you started seeing results. Did that translate into you accomplishing your goals as a hunter as far as harvesting deer was concerned?
Yeah, to an extent. So I always remember this one article I read by Charlie Alsheimer, and it's called like the 5 steps of hunting progression or something like that. I probably didn't get it right, but something like that. And he basically tells you like there's 5 steps. First step is you need to kill a deer and figure out how to make that happen. And then the second step is, you know, kill lots of deer and try to fill all your tags. And then it's maybe the trophy stage where you want to get the biggest deer you can. And then it's maybe more about the land, and then, you know, more about hunting as a group, or hunting as a whole would be the last step maybe. And I kind of feel like I, you you know, I don't know the exact number, but I've killed a bunch of deer, probably 40 deer or something in my life. You know, I'm 32, so I'm, you know, 16, 17 years I've been hunting, whatever. And a lot of them have been does. I've shot some nice bucks, but I don't really care much about shooting a deer anymore. I really more am about, you know, the land and helping other people, learning how to, you know, be better at hunting and helping making their land better in our area. So I think that I've progressed a lot with that. And I think that I kind of like fast forwarded through maybe those last three steps. You know, I have killed nice bucks on my property. Most of the deer that I have killed have been on my property. So yeah, I mean, I would say that I'm happy. I'm hardly ever disappointed with a season, you know. Like, to give you a quick example, this year, a lot of people probably would say if they had the season that I had this year, they'd say that they had a bad season. So I killed one deer I killed a doe with a rifle. I like skimmed a doe with my bow, and that was, you know, I like hit real high and just took some hair off the top of her back. And that was, you know, obviously not a great thing. I wasn't real happy about that. And then I had this buck, real nice buck, one of the better bucks that I've hunted on my land. And I hunted him, and I actually really felt like I was hunting this deer because he was visible in daylight. I saw him, had one good encounter with him, tons of trail camera pictures, tons of daylight pictures, and I was just always in the wrong spot at the wrong time. Like, an example, like I didn't hunt, no, October 29th, I hunted a morning and it got up to like 70 degrees that day. And I just said, I'm not going, you know, I'm going to skip the afternoon and not put my scent out there. And then a week later, when I checked that camera by the stand where I would have hunted, because it was south wind, he walked right by at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, broad daylight, you know, like 15 yards from that stand. So, you know, it was just like a handful of situations like that. And then I mentioned before that I have one other guy that hunts with me during gun. He's been hunting my land since before I was born. He's been hunting there since he was 15. He's 50 years old. And he came out, he hunted the first 3 days, and he shot that buck on the day before Thanksgiving. So like on his third day, I was hunting with him. I was, you know, out in a different stand, and the deer just came to him first. And it was a little disappointing, obviously, in the beginning, like it was the deer I wanted to kill, like, mm-hmm. without a doubt. And, a good deer. He was an 8 point, probably. I sent a picture to you, the guy with the orange, he's wearing the orange jacket. This just shows the rack. That's the buck. And, you know, maybe in the high 120, something like that. Pretty nice 8 point, especially for our, he was like 19 inches wide. So,
right.
It would have been a real, pretty much my biggest buck, I think, or close to it. And, you know, I felt like I had a shot at that deer and I didn't get him, but, you know, I was disappointed in the beginning. And, you know, my grandfather, it was kind of funny. He was really disappointed because he sees how much work I put into it and whatever. But I look at it like now, it's like, you know what? I'm the only thing wrong with that situation is I didn't pull the trigger. Like, I did everything to this land. I attracted that deer to this land, and he lived there. He lived here. He survived through, you know, first week of guns or through 2 days of gun season, and he survived all through bow season, which is not easy, you know, for a deer, especially one that moves in daylight like that. And, you know, the only thing wrong with that for me, from my standpoint, is I didn't pull the trigger. So everything was right. And I did everything except pull the trigger. So who cares about pulling the trigger? You know, it's just, right. It is what it is. And in the future, I'll be, you know, it'll come by me instead. So a different one.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of what I mean. Like, I don't care that much anymore about shooting a lot of deer or shooting, like, as long as I'm happy with how things go and how the deer are reacting, you know, like, right. I think my season this year, I ended passing 10 different bucks. And I, in New York, that doesn't happen a lot to a lot of different hunters. And I think I always, whenever I end a season, and I always add up the number of bucks that I pass. And the biggest reason is because, like I told you in the beginning, about that guy that told me,
yeah,
that you only get one shot at a buck a year. So right. I always laugh to myself about that.
So there's got to be a reason you passed these deer, right? Did mm-hmm. you pass them because they were too young? Did you pass them because they weren't big enough in their rack? Why did you pass all those bucks?
This year specifically, they were all a year and a half old bucks.
Okay.
And in my area, with the class of deer that we have, I kind of am looking at I try to hunt the top 10% of the buck in my.
Based
off their age, and a mixture of age and size, but most of the time, unfortunately, that adds up to a 3.5-year-old buck.
Yeah.
I'm basically always hunting 3.5-year-old bucks. Some years I've actually had where, it was like there's only one 3.5-year-old buck. So you got to add in a 2.5 there once in a while too. Because otherwise you're talking about like the top 1% of bucks if there's only one. So I'm looking at, I probably only have, I'm hunting maybe 3 or 4 deer a year if I'm lucky, some years it's less. And this year they were all year and a half old bucks. They ranged from like a spike to a small 8-point. In the past, last year I passed up, I don't remember the number exactly. It was in that neighborhood of 10. And there was two 2.5-year-olds. One of them was a really nice 2.5-year-old. I would say 90% of the people that I know would have probably shot that deer. But I didn't even think about it. I don't know. It's just funny. Passing a deer for me is almost like anymore. It's a thing that just happens. I don't really have to talk myself into it or out of it. I just don't even stand up. I don't even grab the bow. I just watch.
Right.
And, so it's funny. That deer kind of walked away last year and I kind of thought, man, I'm surprised I didn't shoot that deer. But, I knew he was 2.5. And at the time I just didn't feel like shooting him. So,
right. All right. So we do all these things kind of for a reason. And then I want to after you answer this question, I want to transition to the QDMA part of it. But we do all these things for one reason or another, whether it's because you love to manage land or, by passing these bucks, there's a small part of you that I'm assuming here wants to kill a mature big buck, right? I mean, not necessarily like North America whitetail cover, but big for your area as far as antlers. There's a little part of it, I think, in all of us that gets us, that we kind of have that wish or that dream every year that a big one will walk by our stand. But I guess when it comes to deer, you said you're trying to hunt the top 10%. But is there a cap or a plateau on that? Because you passed 10 year and a half year olds this year. You decided not to shoot. Is that because you're managing, to someday have a 4-year old or older on your property?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like, there's no way that I would know how many of those deer are still alive. So it's tough to tell, but I mean, when I pass a deer, one of the things, you may not hear this in Iowa, but in New York, one of the things you always hear people say is, well, if I don't shoot them, then somebody else is going to shoot them.
Right.
And that's partially true, but they're certainly going to live at least a few more days. Like, you never know. There's a lot better chance if you don't shoot them. So, I kind of have to go with that. And then I would obviously love to be able to hunt 4-year-olds. And I only know a few people in New York that actually say, I'm only going to shoot a 4-year-old, and they probably only shoot a buck every 4 or 5 years, which I'm not too much off of that, but I'm saying 3.5-year-olds, but I think that, I killed one 4-year-old, way before I even started any of this. And that was just, luck. And then I had another buck that I was hunting during, it was, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, that was for sure a 4 year old, and someone else on a different property killed him with a rifle. Those are the only two that I know of, you know, in my 15, 16 years of hunting that existed, you know, around me. Right. And, you know, I'm sure there was more, but it's just, they don't come around very often.
Right.
So I mean, obviously I'm to answer your question, I don't really think that in my mind that it's going to be that way, but it may, you know, and they talk about, there's actually a bill right now in New York that's talking about adding in antler restrictions to our area to try to help build up the population of bucks. And, you know, I don't really know how I feel about that. Personally, it doesn't really affect me too much because I kind of put antler restrictions that are probably more harsh than the ones that they have in their plan, but on myself, but I don't know, you know, I know that's going to make a lot of people mad. As I said, we were right on the border. Pennsylvania has antler restrictions. I think they've been doing it for 11 years. And so I kind of saw how that went because I knew a lot of people from PA and people were really not happy about it. I think it worked. And I probably will get attacked for this by some people because it's a big, big deal. But, and a lot of people still are really mad about it. But, you know, I think it's worked from what I can see. You know, right. I know people that have been hunting there for a long time and shoot bigger deer now. You know, I don't know how you can.
Well, I guess it all comes down to what you want. If you want to shoot the first deer that walks by every year because you want the meat off of it, that's great. But if you shoot a small buck and bitch that there are no small bucks, you're instantly a hypocrite. And hypocrites solve zero problems, right? So you are your own worst enemy in a situation like this. So I for one, am for antler restrictions. For the pure fact that sounds to me like there's plenty of does in your area that can be shot in place of a spike or fork horn buck.
Yeah. So I haven't shot a year and a half old buck in a long time.
Yeah.
And I've never had an empty freezer and I haven't shot a mature buck every year, you know, since I started passing bucks. So, you know, I always have deer in the freezer and they're always, you know, does. So, or a big buck if I'm lucky, you know, but it's, that's the way I see it. There is some people that, like I know people that just go out 3-4 times a year during gun season and they literally will not buy their license if there's antler restrictions, you know, and I don't know what to say to those people because I'm not that guy. So I don't know what to, you know, I don't relate to it really. I guess I understand and I feel bad because they should have the ability to hunt, but they do, you know, they just choose not to. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know how many times I've killed a buck and, you know, and on the same day passed up a few other ones, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like for sure.
Just because you see a 4-point doesn't mean that's the only buck you're going to see. Like, you know, there's probably another one coming down the trail too. So just, you know, I've learned a lot from starting to pass deer.
Yeah, for sure. So where does the Quality Deer Management Association come into play?
Okay. So, New York State is growing QDMA a lot. There's a guy, Mike Edwards. He is the regional director for New York State for QDMA. He just got hired. He's from Rochester, New York area, and he just got hired, I think, 3 years ago. And he's just been building up. I think I don't know the exact number, but I want to say there's at least 12 branches in New York State. And most of them have been started in the last like 3 or 4 years. So he's done a really good job of that. And we were friends on Facebook basically. And he basically reached out to me and said, like, seems like you're really big into this stuff. You know, have you ever thought about starting a branch? And first I was like, nah, you know, I'm too busy. And then I started going to I've been a member of QDMA for maybe 10 years. which basically I'm meaning I'm a member of the national organization. So if you're a member of the QDMA, you're just a member of the national organization. The local branches are really just an entity of themselves, and they just basically help get the spread the message, and they hold events and stuff. So I went to some events in Rochester, which from where I live is maybe an hour away, and they were awesome. It was basically a seminar given by Neil Doherty, which he's a great guy. He's got a lot of good information. And then there was some field days where he was involved and Eric Long was involved. They brought him in. So they basically, you have a field day. Someone offers up their property. You go out to their property. They bring in this expert like Eric Long or Neil, or, you know, we had some local foresters, things like that. And they walk through the property with you. They tell you what's good, what's bad, you know, what they change, you know, what they keep the same. Everything from food plots to hinge cutting to land management of any kind to forestry, all that kind of stuff. And it was just like the best thing ever. Like, I just loved it. It was awesome that this was happening. It was close to home. I was learning a bunch of stuff. You're meeting new people that are involved in the same sort of thing that are kind of in your area. And it really sparked an interest in me. And, you know, this friend that I was mentioning before that went to college together and stuff, he's big into it too. He's also been a member. So we got to talking and we basically said, you know, let's try to start a branch in our county. So we did, 2 years ago, two summers ago, we started. We've had a bunch of successful events. Every year we've had an event or two, and we've had some banquets where we raise money just to hold these other type of events. So we've had field days, we've had seminars. We also we raised a bunch of money at our banquet, which was just a few weeks ago. We're giving a county sportsman's federation. We're giving them money to buy young New York State hunters lifetime hunting licenses. So we're donating enough money, I think, for two or three lifetime hunting licenses for youth. We're talking about the potential of giving scholarships with the money that we raise to students that are graduating, that are trying to go into conservation. And I think one of the biggest things that people, it's the funniest thing to me is how difficult it has been for me to get people to come to events. Right. I don't understand, you know, why. And I think the biggest thing is they think when they hear QDMA, they think that all we're doing is trying to, you know, we're basically trying to say you should do antler restrictions and you should only shoot big bucks and you should only, you know, do this or that. And it, like, if you come to one of our events, like, we hardly talk about bucks. Like, we just talk about the land. We talk about, you know, food plots. We talk about, you know, we talk about stories and tell stories about bucks, but we're never, you know, shoving anything down your throat about what you need to do. We're just giving you, you know, here's an example of what we did and here's how it worked or here's how it didn't work. And, you know, we're not pushing that. And most branches, I can't speak for all of them, but most branches of the QDMA, they're not pushing specific things like that. They're just trying to give people education. You know, the biggest thing is just education and trying to give people better ways to make their land better, to hunt better, to make better decisions from anything, planting trees, cutting trees, food plots, you know, shooting the right number of does, all that kind of stuff. I mean, the nice thing is if you follow all of those other things, that a result is, you know, usually larger, older bucks.
Right.
But it's not the main focus of what we do. And, like I said, I can't speak for everybody, but I know in New York State, most of the branches feel that way. And I know the regional director feels that way. So you're not going to come to an event, you know, in New York and get, you know, blasted about antler restrictions or this or that. I mean, believe me, I'm sure there's going to be some heated discussions about it because it's kind of coming down the pipe for us, but, you know, we're never going to support or, you know, try to push anything that we don't really truly believe in and isn't good for just hunting and deer, but, you know, for the culture of hunting too. You know, I think it's important.
Right.
That's important too.
Right. So You know, before we started recording, you talked about that, you know, after you started this branch, you're starting to see positive things happen because you started this branch in your county. What are some of those positive things that you have seen, I guess, maybe happen on a larger scale in your county? But at the same time, have you seen, since you started that branch, that QDMA branch, have you seen any positive things happen on your 106 acres?
I think that regardless of QDMA, you know, I think that hunting in our entire country is getting better. I mean, I'm sure you've seen that more less year and a half old bucks get killed every year in the whole country. And I think that I'd like to think that QDMA has a lot to do with that. And I think that we are getting the point across to people about just land management. And I know that there's people that have come to our events that have, like, we just had our, like I said, I think it was February 27th. We had our, banquet. And I was talking with guys who I've talked to for 2 or 3 years in a row now, a bunch of different events, that, and they're loving it. And they're literally saying to me, like, I've learned a lot and it's, you know, I've seen it, it's starting to work. And, just seeing how excited people are after being at our events is worth it to me, you know? And I think we're young in our area in order to, like, say for sure that what we're doing is really changing, you know, the habitat or changing the hunting around there. Right. But I think we're getting a start. And I, you know, every year at every event, we have a few more people that show up and new people. And I've never seen anybody leave being like, these guys are a bunch of idiots, you know, like, you know, nobody's ever leaving saying, you know, I'm never coming back here again, you know? So right. That's good. That's my goal. You know, it's not a quick thing that's going to happen, but, you know, maybe in, you know, 10 years or something, I'll be able to say, yeah, everything is a lot better in our county because of our branch, you know? And I really hope that that's possible. I think that, but I do think QDMA has a lot to do with, you know, nationally things getting better with deer hunting. And I think that, because of people, you know, like Brand, you know, people like the QDMA, people like you, people like Mark Kenyon, I think that people are becoming better hunters. They're better informed. And I think they're making better decisions regardless of what those decisions are or what they, you know,
right.
And I think that that's really, really helping. And I think that in the past, people that have maybe not made bad decisions, but made different decisions because of lack of, you know, information available, you know, we didn't have this media that we have available to us now.
Right.
So.
Well, I tell you what, man, that's about an hour. And I really appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast and, you know, chat about how QDMA has worked for not only, you know, the QD quality deer management principles has worked for you and your property, but, you know, how the QDMA, you know, might be able to benefit, you know, a county or, you know, so if you do have, any questions about QDMA and what they stand for and what they do, I suggest you go and, check that out. But Nick, thanks for coming on the podcast, man.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate being here.
Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to an end of today's podcast. Huge shout out to Nick for coming on the show, talking about all his deer management activities that he's doing, and how he started that QDMA gang. And I think that's kind of cool. And I think if we group together as hunters, whether it's by joining a QDMA co-op or doing something else, we can, you know, we can beat the antis and we can have a louder voice in support of the hunters. So huge shout out to all of you guys for taking time to download this podcast. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Huge shout out to the partners of this podcast, Exodus, Deer Lab, Ripcord. Without those guys, I would get a lot more ashtuns from the wife, And other than that, be sure to check me out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. If you want to be a guest on the podcast, whether it's a hunter profile or a BS session, or one thing that I'm looking for a lot between now and the start of the next season is product reviews. So bows, arrows, broadheads, tree stands, camo, gear, boots, accessories, anything that you use, whether you like it or you don't like it, I want to hear what you have to say about the products that we as hunters use on a yearly basis. So, and just remember, it's kind of funny, after this last product review podcast, I got a lot of emails in, and I just want to say that opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one. Whether you agree or disagree, that's beside the point. If you don't like what the other person had to say, maybe you should come on the podcast and review some products as well. So other than that, I hope everybody has a good rest of the week. Thank you very much for tuning in, as always. And if you're going to be up in a tree, man, wear your damn safety harness. Have a good week.